This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the failure to discover weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, the Senate Intelligence Committee started a two-phase investigation. Part one, how and why the intelligence was wrong, finished up, well, more than a year ago. After a dramatic seizure of the Senate by Democrats 2 weeks ago, Republicans agreed to start phase two this week. It focuses on the Bush administration's handling of that intelligence and the politically charged question of whether intelligence was twisted to make the case for war. In a Veterans Day speech on Friday, the president came out swinging. He noted that over 100 Democrats looked at the same intelligence and voted to approve the invasion and charged his detractors with rewriting history. As the phase two investigation begins, we thought it would be helpful to remember what we knew or thought we knew before the war began, what claims were made and when, and we'll ask whether the administration deliberately manipulated an intelligence they knew was thin or if faulty intelligence led them to reasonable conclusions that turned out to be wrong. If you have questions about the intelligence used to bolster the case for war in Iraq, give us a call. And is this debate relevant to the situation now, or is it just politics? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later this hour, we'll look at how history has reflected on the interplay between domestic relations and foreign policy in a somewhat earlier conflict as we talk with Victor Davis Hanson about the lessons of the Peloponnesian War. But first, Iraq, and we'll begin here in Studio 3A with Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for Knight Ridder. Nice to have you on the program again, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
Let's do a little timetable here, Jonathan, starting with the assumptions made following the Gulf War in 1991. What did we initially know about Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction?
Well, it's interesting to start there, because what we thought we knew turned out that we didn't know as much as he had. In fact, it was a major surprise. It was known that he had weapons of mass destruction in terms of chemical and biological weapons. He had used them in the Iraq-Iran war. He had used them against his own people. There was good intelligence that he had a nuclear weapons program. But what turned out was that the nuclear weapons program was far more advanced than the CIA, than American intelligence agencies had predicted before the war.
And proceeding along previously unsuspected routes of potential development.
Absolutely. In fact, they were trying every single route, I believe it was five, to try and develop the fissile material. And that was really where the major effort and their major failing was. The fuel that's required for a nuclear weapon was really what was preventing them in the end from building that weapon. Mm-hmm. But it's something they never actually acquired.
Now, in the long period between the end of the first Gulf War and the beginning of the second, Iraq was repeatedly visited by inspectors for the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, who ferreted out these various programs for atomic weapons development. Yet still, as in the run-up for war, obviously the inspectors had been left Iraq and then came in right near the end again. But there were questions about Iraq's nuclear weapons program, and really they came down, there were a couple of interesting things that they came down to, one of which was the famous aluminum tubes, and the other one was which the yellow cake from the African country of Niger, which goes to the whole Valerie claim, but we'll just talk about the claims for this point. How did those two things affect the public debate, and how did they, were they looked at privately? Were they seen as evidence of a nuclear weapons program in Iraq?
Oh, I think absolutely they were trotted out to the public, at least publicly by the administration, as being evidence of a nuclear weapons program in Iraq. And let's look at the actual history of this. The first time, let's talk about the tubes. The first time we hear about the tubes in public is on September 7th, 2002, when the New York Times published an article quoting unnamed U.S. officials as saying that Iraq had tried to buy thousands of specially designed aluminum tubes for use in high-speed centrifuges. These are devices that spin at extremely high speeds and are used to enrich uranium, to turn uranium gas into highly enriched uranium for use in a nuclear weapon. The following, that same day, this article appeared on the same day as the Sunday Talks, and it just, you could say coincidentally, other people say not, Vice President Cheney and then National Security Advisor, now Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, appeared, and they talked about the tubes. They were able to talk about the tubes, which were, until the New York Times published this story, a very highly classified intelligence matter. Nevertheless, the New York Times having made it public, these two very senior officials were able to talk about them. And when we hear about what they say, there are categorical statements from both officials saying these tubes are for a nuclear weapons program. Condoleezza Rice saying, quote, they're only really suited for a nuclear weapons program, unquote. Then we hear the president addressing the UN the UN General Assembly a few days later, and again makes the categorical statement that these tubes are for an Iraqi nuclear weapons program. What they weren't telling the American public and telling the world was, in fact, there was a dispute over the function of the tubes within the American intelligence community. And indeed, the Department of Energy, which is the top where the top expertise on this kind of matter resides, disputed that conclusion. They and the Intelligence Bureau in the State Department were saying, no, 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 we don't believe these are for a nuclear weapons program, for centrifuges. We believe these are for ground-to-ground rockets. And they based their conclusion on tests that were done on samples of these tubes by U.S. nuclear weapons labs. That information finally comes out in October, in a declassified CIA report to Capitol Hill, in which it talks about this dispute. It discloses that, in fact, while a majority, it says, of U.S. intelligence analysts believes the tubes could be used for high-speed centrifuges, a minority believe that they are not. Mm. And what it turned out was that, in fact, this majority of analysts included analysts who had no expertise whatsoever on this subject.
And this is all important because, it's not just that intelligence kind of works this way. It's rare to get, to get agreement, much less unanimity on anything.
Absolutely. In fact, I was told, and I don't know if this is true, but I was told that President Truman, in fact, said to someone one day, could you find me an intelligence analyst who has no arms, because he won't be able to say to me on the one hand, on the other hand. And so, yes, that it's rare that you have these really definitive conclusions reached in these kind of analyses, unless you actually have eyeballs on what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Now, all right, nuclear weapons. Then there were relations with Al-Qaeda. The urgency of this was supposedly that there was a danger that weapons of mass destruction might be turned over to Al-Qaeda.
Absolutely. And this is, I think, perhaps where the administration's case falls down even more based on what intelligence was available. In fact, right after 9/11, I believe the president himself said to one of his top aides, Richard Clark, find me, show me whether or not Iraq was involved in this. And they went back and scrubbed the intelligence, and in fact, they found no evidence that Al-Qaeda was, or Iraq was, involved in 9/11. Mm-hmm. This began a series, actually, of top-secret CIA analyses on the question of Iraq's relationship with Al-Qaeda. And every single one of these analyses came to the conclusion that while there had been a series of contacts between the two over a decade, none of these rose to the level of actual cooperation between the two. And they concluded, the series of analyses that went right up through January, I believe, of 2003, that there was none of this proof. And in fact, these later analyses discounted the idea that Saddam Hussein would turn over his most valued weapons, if they existed, to a Islamic terrorist group.
Who were fundamentally opposed to a lot of his... there were, though, relations with Mr. al-Zarqawi, who has later emerged now as the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Absolutely. And Mr. I was up in northern Iraq during that period and covered this situation. Mr. Zarqawi was aligned with a who had been trained in al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan, had made his way to northern Iraq, to a tiny sliver of territory controlled in the very, 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 very remote corner of northern Iraq, controlled by a group called Ansar al-Islam. They are Kurds. They are Kurdish Islamic fundamentalists. This little piece of territory backs onto Iran, onto the Iranian border, and it was surrounded by our Kurdish allies. At some point, Mr. Zarqawi shows up in Baghdad with some of his people and apparently had free movement in Baghdad. And this was being seen as evidence that more evidence, perhaps, that Mr. Zarqawi had, in fact, relations with Saddam. However, it turns out that a lot of intelligence analysts actually believed that it was far more convenient for Saddam and his intelligence services to have Mr. Zarqawi in Baghdad, where they could be watched and monitored, rather than up in this tiny sliver of very remote mountainous territory surrounded by Saddam's enemies, the Kurds.
We'll get to calls in just a minute. We're going to bring in some other voices as well. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us, by the way. But the case, as you say, the links to al-Qaeda and the links to nuclear weapons, shaky, even thought so by many before the war. Chemical and biological weapons thought to be much more on firmer grounds.
That's true, but a lot of it, turned out to be based, as we've seen in a number of investigations into this subject, on assumptions that were extrapolated from what UN inspectors had not found or had been accounted for or that Iraq had failed to account for after the first Gulf War. And this was probably where the U.S. intelligence community's greatest failings were, because those were the assumptions that underpinned intelligence assessments that they were giving to the Bush administration. However, when you go and you look at what the actual reports that were coming out of the intelligence community said, there's a lot of shaky stuff in that as well. For instance, in September 2002, there was a DIA report that actually said, we're not sure. We don't really know. We don't really have reliable intelligence.
Jonathan Landay, a national security correspondent for Knight Ridder. He's going to stay with us. And when we come back from a break, we'll be joined by two other voices in this conversation and hear from you as well. 800-989-8255. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. As the Senate Intelligence Committee begins phase two, did the administration distort intelligence to play up the case for war against Iraq? This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Senate Intelligence Committee begins this week its investigation, the so-called Phase 2 investigation, in the uses of intelligence in the run-up to the war against Iraq. Specifically, was intelligence misused? Was it distorted, twisted, to help the administration make the case for war? If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. Let's get a caller in. This is Susan. Susan, call calling us from Forestville, California.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was looking at a Washington Post analysis that was printed on Saturday, and it said there's a couple of things in here. First of all, it said that the president did not share the president's daily brief with lawmakers, and I wanted to know how important that piece was, as well as the fact that the national intelligence estimate summarizing the intelligence was given to Congress just according to the article days before, and that was a 92-page piece that was certainly not shared in enough time to be able to accomplish anything.
Days before the vote is what you're saying, and Jonathan Landay, I think she's talking about the president's briefing in terms of his comments that those Democrats who voted to support the war saw the same intelligence that I did.
Well, I think it's true that the Democrats did see the intelligence that was contained in the national intelligence estimate, and I believe that pertinent parts of the president's daily brief were shared with one of the investigative committees that commissions that looked at this question.
Not according to the Washington Post.
Okay. The fact is, though, that much of what is in the president's daily brief should be in the national intelligence estimate presented to Congress.
Much of it, but not all of it.
Well, there was other sources of information that the White House and the Pentagon were using in making their case for war that the Senate did not see. This was intelligence that was coming from Iraqi defectors presented, supplied to the United States by the Iraqi National Congress of Mr. Ahmed Chalabi. A lot of this information, some key pertinent pieces of this information, in fact, did make it into the administration's case for war, and it all turned out to be bogus. Now, talking about the National Intelligence Estimate, it's really an issue that was looked at by the Senate Intelligence Committee in their Phase 1 investigation, but I don't think has really been succinctly explained, because what we see happen was that in the National Intelligence Estimate, and we've seen declassified key judgments from this document, every single judgment that is made by the intelligence community has got qualifications to them, has got comments such as, we judge that, we assess that, we judge that we are seeing only a portion of Iraq's WMD efforts. There are dissents in there from the State Department's Intelligence Bureau over whether or not Saddam had it reconstituted his nuclear, or was trying to reconstitute his nuclear weapons program. You see a dissent in there from the Air Force that basically discounted the idea that Saddam was developing unmanned aerial vehicles that could deliver chemical or biological weapons. And if you compare all of that to the public version of that same document that was released at the same time, all of those caveats have been removed. All of those caveats that raise the question, well, we're not quite sure of this, we're not quite sure of that. Phrases like lacking persuasive evidence, we assess that, although we have little information on Iraq's chemical weapons stockpile, all of that was removed from the document that was given to the public. And beyond that, you don't hear any of those caveats that were made by the administration officials in arguing their case.
So were those caveats given to the Senate?
Then that's the other question. Absolutely. In fact, those caveats, the Senate and the House had access to both these documents. They had the ability to take both documents, put them side by side and compare them, and those edits, those defects would have leapt out to them, as they did to me, because I actually was the first to do this. I took both documents, I compared them, and I found these huge gaps between both.
Susan, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Bill Arkin. William Arkin's a former Army intelligence analyst and author most recently of Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. He joins us from Sweet Spot Digital Studios in Vermont. Bill, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
Do you believe, and obviously there's a much more evidence that we've not had the time to get into, but do you believe that the administration was, in eliminating some of those caveats, twisting the case for war against Iraq, or was it doing a sort of an understandable, we've decided to do this, let's campaign for it?
Well, the nature of threat and intelligence is guilty until proven innocent. It's not the other way around, and that's the way it's always been, especially in places that are denied territory, the mm-hmm. Soviet Union, China, Iraq, etc. So I think that I've heard the words twisted, manipulated, distorted. Those are quite separate words, by the way. They mean different things. And I guess I would say that the Bush administration distorted the intelligence in the sense that they were more sure than the intelligence actually represented. Yet at the same time, they were also very explicit in stating that they were leaning in the direction of assuming guilt because of Saddam Hussein's history and because of all of the gaps which existed in their own intelligence. I don't particularly blame the Bush administration for that, by the way. Is it a case of PR, Neil? Well, the Bush administration used intelligence as the main argument for why a preemptive war against Saddam Hussein was necessary. And that was not just about Iraqi nuclear weapons. It was not just about Iraq's connections with al-Qaeda. It was not just about remotely piloted vehicles, aluminum tubes, or uranium from Niger. But what it was about the accumulation of hundreds of different bits of information, which seemed to suggest to most people at the time that Saddam Hussein was continuing to pursue weapons of mass destruction in violation of UN Security Council resolutions and his own obligations, and that eventually the sanctions regime against Iraq was going to fail or weaken to such a degree that the Iraqis would be able to reconstitute their weapons of mass destruction program. I'm not aware of very many people who were in Washington in the mainstream elite debate who disagreed with that proposition, neither from the Clinton administration nor the Bush administrations. So the question in my mind as we debate this today is, to what degree did the Bush administration exaggerate the information which they had in order to twist the arm of the American public and the international community to do something that they wanted to do anyhow, which was to depose Saddam Hussein and remake Iraq? And I think the answer is they did an awful lot of exaggerating. They did an awful lot of distorting. But when I hear Jonathan Landay or others these days recounting the history, I also hear a lot of cherry-picking on their part and a lot of exaggerating on their part in terms of what evidence they're choosing to select to demonstrate that the Bush administration was, in fact, manipulating or twisting the information. I think the Bush administration was as much in the dark as most other people were, and they made a calculated decision.
And that, I think, is the sound of an electronic glitch between us and Vermont. Bill Arkin's line is down, and we'll try to get him back on the program shortly. In the meantime, Cherry Picker, you want to respond to that?
Absolutely.
To Jonathan Landay?
Absolutely. I think, you know, Bill is arguing, I think, from the point of view, again, of the mainstream elite and what they were arguing about. If you go back to what we were reporting beginning in September of 2002, just before the aluminum tube story came out, we started reporting then that there was no intelligence that pointed to an imminent threat by Saddam Hussein. The people who were talking to us, and these were people who were both working stiffs within the military, the diplomatic corps, the intelligence community, and senior officials who were seeing the very same information that policymakers were seeing, were saying to us, wait a minute, we don't see what they're seeing.
Bill Arkin is back on the line with us. Sorry for that electronic interruption there, Bill.
That's fine. You know, the question to me, Neil, is not whether or not Saddam was an imminent threat. I don't think he was. I think a lot of people have concluded at this point, knowing what we know now, that he wasn't. The point, however, about weapons of mass destruction was I wasn't really hearing a lot of dissent about the general proposition that the Iraqis were trying to reconstitute their weapons of mass destruction program. And even if you take individual elements of the evidence, it's a little bit more complex than just saying it in one way. Aluminum tubes, as an example. Yes, it's true that the Department of Energy raised questions about this, but Army intelligence also at the same time said, well, if these are for multiple rocket launchers, then they have tolerance levels that far exceed what is necessary in order to shoot rockets, 81-millimeter rockets, out of these tubes. And so it does leave a question as to whether or not the Iraqis are obtaining something for other purposes. And I think there was a tendency on the part of the intelligence community, which then infected the Bush administration over a long period of time, to assume a lot more than they actually had facts about because they had been burned so many times before in their failure to understand what the corners were that Iraq was willing to go around in order to do what they wanted to do. The Iraqis never used the technologies that we would use, and so therefore we couldn't always dismiss equipment or technologies that weren't exactly perfect for the purpose, because it might be the case that the Iraqis were willing to cut corners in order to use those tubes for that purpose. I'm not disagreeing with Jonathan Landay's general proposition that the hesitations of those agencies were overlooked or were trodden over in the PR campaign, but the reality was that there were enough questions along a broad number of pieces of evidence that accumulated to say, wow, it may be indeed the fact that Saddam Hussein is trying to reconstitute his weapons program.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation. This is Mike, and Mike's calling us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Listen, I don't understand what difference any of this discussion makes when the real point is whether or not he had, and you can assume that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction or the ability to put them together. They didn't allow the UN to go on and continue their inspections. And many, many people have said that had they been allowed to continue their inspections, even if Saddam had the capability, that he would have been so busy hiding his capability that he wouldn't have had a chance to use it. So what difference does all this make?
Well, Bill Arkin, I think there's a couple of questions of fact there.
Well, I think that there is a valid question to be asked about the timing of the war in Iraq. And certainly anyone who now understands the history could look back and say, what was the Russian trying to get the United Nations to complete its work and to reach a conclusion before, in fact, they were necessarily ready to do so? I think the answer to that question is, boy, we had just experienced 11 years of Iraqi cheating and deceiving and retreating and giving half the story. And it wasn't altogether clear that Iraq was finally going to cooperate with the UN inspectors in 2002 and 2003 any more than they had in the previous decade. Mm-hmm. I think that, though, there is a valid question about the Bush administration's decision to go to war and its timetable for doing so. And here I'm afraid I have to reach the conclusion that the Bush administration essentially decided to go to war against Iraq in early 2003 because they didn't want to withdraw all of their forces from the Gulf region, forces that had been fighting in Afghanistan. It was essentially for their convenience, if you will, that we had our forces mobilized, that we had the plans all in track, and that the United Nations was important in terms of creating the international aura of a consensus. But the reality was that the Bush administration didn't want to necessarily not take advantage of a twofer, if you will,
right,
and take down Saddam Hussein at the same time that it had achieved the elimination of the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about politics and the weapons of mass destruction and the run-up to the war with Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we're going to get another caller in here before the break. This is Tim. Tim calling us from Rumford, Rhode Island.
Hello. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
Great. I'll make this quick and a very necessary discussion, and thank you for having it. My question kind of revolves around a cultural fear I have, and it seems we're becoming a society that does not seek, demand, or value objective fact. And every time you hear about free war intelligence, gentlemen, all they talk about, as your guests have already stated, is how their ideas are skewed. Well, I think the public forgets that these are supposed to be the most qualified experts at the highest levels. I'm thinking of Colin Powell's speech before the UN about WMD. He has already called that a low point in his career. Bush mentioned in one of his speeches a mushroom cloud at one point. I really think they were trying to use fear to get the public behind this. Now, my question, how can we have an objective investigation of pre-war intelligence, when politics is the thick, multi-foot top layer and people do things for their own political entailment, for the retaining of power, placing of blame? It's not about objective fact. How do we, what mechanisms are in place so we, the public, can have an objective discussion?
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Landay?
Real quick, I think that's why a lot of people would like to see Phase 2 completed, because in theory, one learns lessons from what happens in the past, and the public holds its politicians accountable, hopefully, so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again, and you get some kind of mechanism put in place to guard against this kind of thing. But one can be pessimistic also and doubt that that's going to happen.
I also doubt that we're actually going to have enough time with how quickly things are moving in the Middle East. You know, terrorism is increasing, and Bush justifies every action with the war on terror. It's really insulting.
Mm-hmm. There was just today, I think, Pat Roberts of Kansas said in the newspapers, quoted as saying that if the situation were presented again, obviously senators would be much more reluctant to vote as quickly as they did in the past when asked a lot more questions. So there is a reflection on of past events on future consequences. Tim, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you for the time.
And Bill Arkin, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
William Markin's the author most recently of Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World, and he joined us on an ISDN line from Vermont, and we're going to take a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, by the way, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. When we come back, we'll talk with Tom Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute, who's author of Operation Iraqi Freedom, A Strategic Assessment. We'll also be talking with classicist and military historian Victor Davis Hanson about his new history of the Peloponnesian War. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we are talking about Phase 2. Was intelligence before the war in Iraq manipulated, distorted, twisted, exaggerated? Take your pick to justify the case for invasion. Our guests are Jonathan Landay, a national security correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers, who's with us here in Studio 3A. And also joining us in the studio is Tom Donnelly. He's a resident fellow in defense and national security studies at the American Enterprise Institute, the author of Operation Iraqi Freedom, A Strategic Assessment. And Tom, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. And
again, I guess it's that same question. Given the quality of the intelligence, which was not great, did the administration distort, exaggerate, manipulate, twist, lie about the intelligence in order to make the case against for war?
Well, that's a rich menu of sins of which the administration stands accused. But making the case for lying, I think, is going to be real, real difficult, because as the previous guests have observed, much of the intelligence that was available to the administration was available to the Clinton administration and also to the Congress. And scrubbing words like "we assess" or "we conclude" from national intelligence estimates, I don't think is going to be enough of a political lever to really make the president's opponents or to get him over the policy gold line that they're shooting at, which is obviously something more than a historical reexamination of how we went to war. So, you know, unless there's some much larger smoking gun in this phase two review or investigation than has been uncovered in the actually quite substantial investigations that have come before, it's difficult for me to see that other than as a political measure, that this is going to carry much weight.
Mm-hmm. As you look at the case, look at what's going on now. You're talking about the policy goal of the critics, the Democrats, which would be presumably, or what you're talking about is an attempt to get a Republican-controlled Senate to denounce the Republican administration. Not likely.
Well, and some people have suggested that there is an impeachment trial at the end of this after the 2006 elections in which the Democrats presumably recover congressional leadership. So there's a lot of conspiracy theories about where this process is heading. But I think in general, the Democrats are continuing to try to use the war in Iraq as a stick to beat the president with. It's been very successful. It's been largely unanswered for quite a while now, despite the fit of response from the White House last week.
Mr. Hadley, the national security correspondent, and then the
president. And the president himself, of course.
And he's scheduled to do something, we're told, quite similar at Elmendorf Air Force Base in Alaska on his way to China tonight.
Well, the question is, can he get the toothpaste back in the tube? There's been, a long period of he lied, we were lied to, we were misled, that's gone unanswered. And this is a matter of presidential credibility that will be sort of difficult to reverse, I think, just as a political question, less as a factual question.
Let's see if we get another caller in on this point. This is Rick. Rick's calling us from, where is that? Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester, Massachusetts, yes, thank you. The question I have is whether the real reason we went to war was to install democracy in the region as a strategy to fight terrorism, but that that would be too difficult to sell the American public and the Congress, so they chose weapons of mass destruction.
Tom Donnelly, there was that one quote of, well, weapons of mass destruction is the one that we can show to the American people, but there's a range of reasons why. And the president did make a speech on democracy in the Middle East before the
Congress. He did. As a matter of fact, he made it at the American Enterprise Institute's annual dinner. It was just about 6 weeks before the actual kickoff of hostilities, however. So the argument evolved from, say, the time of the congressional vote through the time we actually went to war. And it actually touched a lot of bases. It was democracy promotion, broader stability in the Middle East, weapons of mass destruction, of course. Also, the argument that actually legally we've been in a war with Saddam since the end of Operation Desert Storm. So there was a rich menu of reasons for taking issue and trying to remove Saddam from power, but the administration really did stress the WMD arguments as the central one. There's no question about that.
Jonathan Land, I was going to say that WMD really was the centerpiece of their case.
Well, no, not just WMD. The idea that the WMD could be given to terrorists. This was especially poignant after 9/11. I think to set the atmosphere, look, you had an administration that came in that really wasn't focusing on al-Qaeda and terrorism. When it first came into office, it was looking at missile defense, in terms of foreign policy, missile defense, transformation of the military, and then 9/11 happens. And suddenly, there's this atmosphere created wherein you have policymakers who are looking at some of this intelligence and looking at what al-Qaeda did and kind of putting the two together. You also had this prejudice that was brought in, and some of it very justified by Vice President Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and others, against the CIA's ability to basically do its job. They looked at the record. The CIA had failed to make some important predictions about the Soviet Union, had failed to predict that detect that India was going to detonate a nuclear weapon. There's a whole realm of things that they came into, and they actually talked about it publicly before the war. They got it wrong when they assessed the state of Saddam's pre-1991 Gulf War nuclear weapons program. And so they came into office with this predisposition to distrusting the analysis they were getting from their intelligence community, and set up their own analytical mechanisms to look at the same intelligence and take other intelligence and put it together.
I would say the big difference really is a policy difference over how to deal with the Middle East. That was, just in my judgment, the fundamental difference that really goes the longest way towards explaining the whole pattern of Bush administration behavior. It was the belief of the Bush administration principles that American policy of sort of containing the problems of the Islamic world or the Middle East or whatever term of art you want to use was a failure. And that began with the conclusion of the first Gulf War. It was reinforced by events like the Cole bombing, the Khobar Towers bombing. Certainly, September 11th put us into an entirely different dimension in this regard. But the problem of Iraq and the broader political problems and security problems caused by the Middle East, I think is the architecture that wires all these data points together.
I'm afraid we're just going to have to end there. Phase two will, we're told, be done by the end of the year. Maybe this conversation will be as well. We'll be sure to be talking with both of you again. Tom Donnelly, thanks very much. Tom Donnelly at the American Enterprise Institute, and also Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for Knight Ridder. Both of them were kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from the break, the Peloponnesian War.